WBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about
KBOO. This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer and editor Max Porter. After receiving a master's in art history, Max Porter worked in bookstores, winning the 2009 Bookseller of the Year Award, and eventually became an editor and then editorial director at Granta and Portobello Books, working with authors such as Rebecca Solnit, Ben Marcus, Eleanor Catton, and Hong Kang. Max Porter, however, is best known for his debut novel, Grief is a Thing with Feathers, a book that was shortlisted for the British Book Industry Debut Fiction Book of the Year, the Goldsmiths Prize, the Guardian First Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle John Leonard First Book Prize, and which won the 2016 International Dylan Thomas Prize and the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year Award. Max Porter is here today on Between the Covers to talk about his follow-up, his second novel entitled Lanny, just out from Grey Wolf Books. Lanny has received starred reviews from Library Journal, Booklist, Kirkus, and Publishers Weekly. And a kindred spirit to Grief is a Thing with Feathers, Lanny is also a book that resists categorization. For instance, Booklist says Porter has created both an entertaining tale and a novel of exceptionally creative experimentation and genre extension. Publishers Weekly describes Lanny as a combination of pastoral, satire, and fable. Library Journal calls it an edge-of-your-seat read, and Kirkus calls it elegantly mysterious. Kamala Shamsi says it shouldn't be possible for a book to be simultaneously heart-stopping, heart-shaking, and pulse-racing. And Ocean Vuong describes Lanny as a powerful yet tender reclamation of the imagination, love, and art-making, all of it a brilliant defense of the outsider's tenuous foothold in society. Welcome to Between the Covers, Max Porter.
Thanks for having me.
So much as Lanny troubles genre distinctions as a novel whose building blocks feel more like prose poems and with an attention to the visual on the page, there are also many themes to the novel that one wouldn't necessarily expect to find together. A meditation on place and the idea of home, on childhood and the imagination, an engagement with the despair of the political moment and of environmental catastrophe that we're hurtling toward, all of which is somehow also folded into a crime narrative and an ecological fable. So I'm curious about how all of this started, because in one interview you said your first attempts at this book were rather unhealthy because, as you put it, your political feelings collapsed into the effort. This suggested to me the possibility that what you wanted to say was getting in the way of creating art. So I was hoping we could start there with the ways the things that motivated you to sit down and to begin were also possibly the things you needed to navigate around to write Lanny.
Yeah, it began for me with the story of the old man and the boy. I wanted to write about friendship, and I wanted to write about a creative, educational relationship, a platonic relationship where something is being taught, but outside of the context of school and educational systems, and no grading, no right or wrong, and no good or bad. So all those sort of qualitative, horrible things we put on kids' lives very early on, I don't know how it is here, but very early on in the UK, kids are being graded and marked, and it's the same as the kind of diagnostic culture, it's very unhealthy. And so I wanted to write this sort of love story, really, between two people based on the physicality of making work and marks on the page and looking at the world and teasing meaning out of the world. And that be not a sexual relationship, of course, but certainly an erotic relationship because of the properties of art making and affection between two people and also human beings in the wild. So that's, as you say, what's the kind of ecological heart of the book is this rapture, this very natural, not at all overdetermined and not at all at that age political relationship this kid has with the natural world. And then I was like, right, I'll set it in an English village. And then I started to write it, and it became flooded with this kind of caricature of casual xenophobia and like petty ideas of small island nationalism and stuff. And then at a certain point, I realized that actually that's how it is. Like, I didn't need to be particularly subtle about those things because they are not presenting themselves subtly in the UK. Same as it is here. Like, if you were going to write about the rise of populism in the States and stuff, there's nothing subtle about that. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the problems perhaps in our community is that we've tried to be subtle about something that, you know, or we've tried to be rigorous and nuanced in our analysis of some of this stuff when actually it's just blunt. It's just unpleasant and it's unkind, and you need therefore blunt tools to handle blunt materials. So yeah, that's how I started, and then I sort of thought, well, one of the things I can do is just, unlike in my first book where it was very autobiographical, I can have a lot of fun building these people in this place. So I just started building. I invented people and I gave them lives and inner lives, and I started modeling them. And I found, like, suddenly I was totally in love with writing, with the idea of inventing things and then testing them against themselves, and then they kind of answer back in a way that you hear writers say, you know, that my characters spoke back to me. I found that to be true.
Hmm. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the building of people in this book. You've talked before about the desire to leave as many doors open for the reader as possible, and you said that when talking about how you portray your characters, that actually more happens the more you leave out. That there are many things you don't need to tell us. And then in a sense, it's in the editing process that you prevent yourself from over-determining your characters. So I'd like to hear about this ethos of yours, and then the process around how you render a character on the page, sort of by removing things from the character.
I think it comes from reading a lot of poetry and realizing that there's a certain amount of exactitude and that you can achieve with economy. And that the novel, particularly the kind of modern, as it were, like social realist novel, and particularly a certain type of cool, urbane, relatively cosmopolitan novel, tells you absolutely everything and kind of wallops you around the head with exposition. So there isn't much room for thinking. And I find that disappointing as a reader. I find it boring. But also I find that it's an easy way for novelists, even and perhaps accidentally sometimes or subconsciously, to just ladle their own politics into a book, which means that there isn't any space for my politics to mingle and for me to learn anything about the world. And given that ambiguity is one of the principal characteristics of life on Earth as a human being, like, not knowing is interesting. When you know something or you're told something, there's no growth. So my whole philosophy really of fiction is that you can quite deftly and quickly, with a turn of phrase or a line, get to the truth of a thing and then leave it there for the reader to become complicit in or to misjudge or even correctly guess at. And that if you do that across a whole book with a kind of tapestry of economy like that, or of white space, as in the case of my first book, then the energy that's generated for the reader when they move from one thing to another, or they get to the end of the book and they're like, oh, I recognize that name. I think I thought that person was a fool. And they go back and realize that actually they've been sort of tricked into thinking that, you know, it means that the book is alive after you've turned the final page for us as philosophical and political beings, you know, imbibing this stuff. Otherwise, you're just saying, eat this, with no opportunity for response or collaboration. I do think books are collaborative efforts, really, between the reader and the text. And if they're not, then there's a kind of tyranny there for me.
Yeah, I wanted that. Go further with that idea of collaboration, because there's a quote that you've said that I'm going to read back to you that makes me feel like maybe...
You're going to read it in my own voice.
No, I wish I could. I wish I could. But it sort of feels like a way in which you might be connecting environmental concerns, or the way your environmental concerns manifest on the level of syntax. So you've said you can get to a person, both a character and a role within a community, their socioeconomic type, their psychosexual type. You can do that in just half a line. You just set them up deftly in relationship to other things. It's not what they are on their own. It's how they're responding organically to the other things in their ecosystem. And I guess I wonder, do you see this as a personal ethos beyond an aesthetic ethos, in the sense that identity or the building of characterization at heart is a relational thing, the way you're describing also the collaboration between reader and writer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yes. And I want the text to be, it's a nice quote. I'm pleased with that.
Yeah, you sound pretty smart.
I want the text to be a living thing, and therefore for its politics to be breathing and a kind of membrane through which the one reading experience moves, but isn't set, isn't trapped, and therefore that the book changes it with every encounter with its reader, and I hope that it would change every time I read it as well. And that's one of the, I mean that literally, because I've got these flowing voices, these overheard voices in the book, but I think I also mean it in terms of not locking people in with too much. Like, for example, I don't particularly have a hierarchy between different types of conversation, you know, between different types of encounter between human beings. And I guess that comes, I mean, you want to connect it to the environmental ethos. I suppose that comes from, I was thinking about this last night, actually. I think it's a kind of an animist impulse at work on my, and I didn't really think about this while I was writing. It came naturally, and it's only after it that one can be analytical after the fact. I think it's to do with the fact that human beings aren't the only consciousnesses at work in the world, and that grotesque things have occurred because of our sense of superiority in nature. And actually what Lanny represents is a very natural recognition that other things are more powerful than us, and probably have greater longevity and greater skill and greater survivability and all this kind of stuff. So really what pours out of him is respect and awe. He's very awestruck as a person, and therefore he's in pain because the adult world and the world of inequality starts to make him feel extremely. And that was the case for all of us. You know, that moment of sort of political awakening when you're 10 or 11 and you start to find the world very painful to look at. And you don't want to lose that rawness. And you almost have, at that age and into your teenage years, you have a campaigning instinct that adults say you'll get over, because sooner or later capitalism and its methods will just envelope you and deaden those nerve endings and you know, make you behave like a zombie like your parents do, or whatever it is. And so he's just coming into that, and therefore has, for me, his politics are quite progressive. And I don't even need to tell you what they are. You can guess at them, and you see them on the page. But he has effortlessly such things like quite radical philosophical traits, such as like forgiveness and equality in nature. And so he's a kind of proto-pagan, like he's a kind of non-doctrinaire pagan. And a lot of kids are. So when you get reviews of this book, particularly on the right in the UK, sort of like, oh, he's just pretentious, he's just annoying. Mm. It's like, well, what is it he's saying that annoys you? Because he's not saying anything particularly weird, but he's obviously, what you're saying, what you're reading in him is obviously a reprimand of the way you think, or the way that you've become acclimatized to certain lazinesses or something in your thinking. So I find that very interesting, that he's a mirror, because he hardly says anything. And yeah. I don't give him anything, really. He's almost like an absence in the middle of the book.
And he is sort of a rebuke to his own dad, or his dad, I think, feels him as a rebuke to maybe some of his own choices. And yeah. I want to maybe talk more about this idea that you know, children are expected to eventually get enfolded into the disappointment of the adult capitalist world.
Yeah.
Because it feels like one of the biggest relational aspects of Lanny is around place and the way different characters are defined by how they either engage with place or ignore the place that they're in. Mm. And I kind of wanted to start with, maybe you could just start with describing Lanny's parents, who they are and what motivates them to move out to the countryside in the first place to live outside of London, right, and yet commute back into London to work.
For Robert, who is a kind of worker bee of late capitalism, he says by his own admission, in a moment of kind of reflexiveness at the end of the book, that he is only defined in this place, or, you know, his only permission to be in this place is arranged for him by a mortgage lender. So it is a transaction for him. And he lives there because of its proximity to London. And therefore he is alarmed and, as you say, like rebuked in some way by Lanny's apparently immediate organic rapport with the place. But which you can't buy, you know, like the horrible racist neighbor says, you cannot buy a sense of belonging on your mobile phone. And he's sort of slightly gutted that you can't, because that was his assumption, you
right.
know. And that, you know, for him, he's very much a millennial, in as much as like he actually probably would look on his phone and see if there's an app to village life, or if there's a, like, a way to be friends with it. Like, respectability is his fetish. He wants to be liked, and he wants to, England is a place pinpricked all over and riven, you know, like a kind of piece of scar tissue by class. Class is the great elemental force in British society. So he's desperate to be liked by, like, the skinhead in the pub, the football fan, but also by the landowning guy. And he so his whole thing is a sort of performance of half country, half city. Jolie is different. She's in some respects a traumatized person. She speaks quite candidly, but barely at all, about postnatal depression. So you know that the village for her is a place to regrow herself after years of pain. And she's been involved in a world that she found distasteful, the world of acting. And now she's writing. It felt obvious to me to make her write because I am someone that has to be making stuff the whole time. And so if you told me I couldn't write, I'd paint. And if you told me I couldn't paint, I'd sing. And, you know, and she's of that ilk, as many of us are. So she's writing, and she's writing relatively traumatic things because she's interested in it. She's interested in harm against the woman's body. And I wanted her to be smart. I didn't just want her to be, like, endlessly moaning about her husband being away. That felt too much like a cliche. And actually, none of the people I know, men or women, would actually allow themselves to be defined by that anyway. So I wanted her to have a bit of an edge to her. And I'm interested in psychoanalysis, and I wanted her to be slightly unknowingly kind of representative of the kind of Kleinian good enough mother thing, you know, this kind of agony of her relationship with Lanny, which has, like, a bit like the art making relationship with Pete, is almost a kind of an erotic vocabulary there in the raising of children and the pain of losing children, in that loss being built into the love that's there at the beginning and stuff. And the village for her is there is no idea of kind of rural romanticism attached to it for her. She finds it noisy and intrusive and tight and judgmental. She walks into a kind of spider's web of, like, relatively toxic and specific local assumptions about people and stuff like that. And some of that is kind of a legacy of the religious community that a place like that would have. Some of it's the kind of way in which those places are now. Look at Brexit, for example. Like, Brexit goes down right into these places. Like, families fall apart over it. Like, that we are a country at war with itself. And I never wanted to speak explicitly about that, or, God forbid, write a Brexit novel, but I hope it's present. When the village folds in on itself with them kind of caught in the middle, you see that these are traits that they're universal.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it was interesting, because the long-term residents, they resent the gentrifiers who are coming in, the commuters who aren't really part of the place. But you don't get the sense that the long-term residents have a more enlightened relationship to the land. No. In fact, they seem motivated by fear and nationalism and petty concerns of property.
Or just even the necessity of their routines. I mean, that's the thing, we are odd creatures of habit, aren't we? So most people's relationship to the land isn't even defined by ecological fact. I am breathing air that is filtered by these trees, or I am drinking water that has come up from these springs or whatever. It's literally just a place to walk their dog.
Right.
Like, or it's a route to the football pitch or a route to the pub. Like, most people's lack of engagement in it is actually, like, almost sociopathic. I don't know what the ecological equivalent of that would be, like a kind of Anthropocene blindness to the fact that you are living on a planet that sustains you. Almost like you're playing a video game. You haven't actually realized you're made of the same atoms, as he says, as this place.
It made me theorize about why the two human characters that seem most connected to the land in a non-pathological way are Lanny and the older avant-garde artist who is famous in London but merely eccentric in the town, that everyone calls Mad Pete. And neither one of them have a long history in the town. So whatever communion that they're having isn't through longevity in this place, it's through something else. And I was thinking at first that perhaps in the case of Lanny, it's a quality of childhood. And for Pete, it is a byproduct of being an artist. But in the end, I was wondering if it had something to do with being motivated and animated by curiosity rather than fear. If there was, like, something about being inquisitive and curious that you are connecting to a different sort of land ethos.
Yeah, I think I am. And I think that probably is just, that is just a poetic instinct alive in anybody or anything, that you stop and look and you stop and connect the growth of a thing with its decomposition a season later, or you know, you connect water being pulled up into a tree with water being poured into your belly. You know, that's why Dead Papa Toothwort had to be existed as a character. I'm sure we'll get to him, but like, he's what you realize is he is both of them, and if he is existing in either, it's because there's this sort of perfect jouissance, like this kind of ecstatic sweet spot that exists when you have. I mean, we know this from being readers of poetry or even like great theology or anything. Like, you, the observation carries with it the seed of a potential enlightenment further down the road, and some people just aren't open to or interested in that enlightenment, therefore that there is hostility immediately present in being someone that chooses to stop and look.
Yeah.
And that's all they're doing together, Pete and Lanny. It's not to do with like how well he can draw or whether he's going to get better marks in his art lessons at school. It's just that they're looking at stuff together.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to the writer and editor Max Porter about his second novel from Grey Wolf, Lanny. So even though you describe Lanny, the child, as maybe a universal in terms of his politics, or maybe not universal, but a common politics for someone who's 10 or 11 as a child, Lanny's parents and the town folk, they see Lanny as utterly different than them and sort of uncanny in many ways. They describe him as away with the fairies or almost possessed. At one point, when we are in Lanny's mom's point of view, there's a line that she says, she realizes that life at home, his time at school, what she thought of as his real existence, was only a place he visited. And that line reminded me of something Ursula K. Le Guin has said about home. And she said that home isn't your family, nor is it your house where you live, but rather that home is imaginary. But by that, she doesn't mean non-existent. So in her specific words, she said, home imagined comes to be. It is real, realer than any other place, but you can't get to it unless your people show you how to imagine it, whoever your people are. I just was curious how that struck you.
No, well, I mean, all praise to Ursula K. Le Guin. I mean, that's about it, right? Certainly, Lanny is... The idea of him being, like, cute or pretentious or whatever, I find it relatively disappointing as a reading, only because he actually has some sting in his tail, and that is judgment. And I think you have to listen to the judgment of children. I think when your children turn around and say you are mired in hypocrisy and short-term thinking and etc., you ought to listen, because they're not saying that. They're saying that because they see things freshly, and they're at the beginning of their political formulation or whatever, or spiritual in this case. So the fact that Lanny wants to be in the forest more than he wants to be at home, and he wants to be building something in the forest that is an act of love to the people, because he feels that isn't happening enough in the world as he sees it. He recognizes, you know, how art galleries work and how churches work and why people like to go to sport together and stuff, but what he doesn't think is happening is a communal adoration and excitement about natural forms and looking carefully at things that have grown, and he tries to fix that. And that is a kind of there's an element of self-righteousness there. You can see that, I suppose. There's a kind of preachiness, I suppose, that some people might react to. I mean, some people find him actively annoying in that regard. I didn't even really think about that when I was. But I don't see Lanny. I see Jolie thinking about Lanny. I see Robert thinking about Lanny. I never built him as a character. He's the only one I didn't need to, because I'm more interested in what other people think of him. And then I suppose what I'm more interested in is what the woods are feeling when he is in them, and they feel that he's a friend. And so ultimately it's a kind of love letter to friendship between us and the world. And obviously what, as you point out yourself, like, why is it that the child has that friendship and the retired avant-garde artist has that friendship, but no one really in between does? No one else is invited into to do that. And that comes close to the kind of, yeah, that comes close to the kind of ecological wishful thinking at the end of the book and everything.
Well, to connect that to the idea of more happening by taking more out, the book is mostly told through a rotating first-person narratives. We jump from one person's head to another, and as you said, you were more interested in what people thought of Lanny than what Lanny himself was thinking. He didn't strike me as annoying or precious in any way as a reader, but I was just curious about this book named Lanny, with a central character named Lanny,
yeah,
and with Lanny being a central absence.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about that. Because Lanny, I mean, there are a couple times when Lanny speaks, but for the most part, we join all these other characters in seeing Lanny through the way others relate or talk about Lanny,
yeah,
rather than from Lanny.
I just believe it's a more powerful method of creating a thing, in the same way as, I mean, I just happened to see this poet's name written down here. The River Dart in Alice Oswald's book, The River Dart, is never described like it begins here and it's small and then it gets bigger and then X number of people live in it. And she creates the river by telling us how it is considered both by the natural world around it and by the people that use it. So it becomes a mirror of human activity. And that is therefore immensely powerful beyond any geological or topographical consideration of a river that I might be able to create for myself using things I know about rivers. It means that it is in me. And I want Lanny to therefore be in you as a reader. So if I told you how old he was and like what his accent sounded like and how he looked or what kind of, that would just interrupt that work for you. Same way as having a cover of a book with a picture of the character on is just horrible interruption of the imaginative work of building it for yourself. And I had to find that out myself. Like when I was writing the book, there were some scenes that were preventing that work happening, I think. And they tended to be sort of accidental exposition on my part to do with things like sexuality or good and evil. You know, like the kind of I suppose the kind of narrative architecture of the place. And I just realized I don't need to do that at all. Like, I've done that work, but my reader doesn't need to know I've done it. I can take it all out and it become, you know, my village is not your village. And that was, I learned that in my first book where I had the mum and I took her out so that she could be more powerful in absentia. And I suppose it might be something I'm interested in beyond this book as well. Because I do credit readers with unbelievable versatility. Like, people have read a lot of books and read across forms in ways that like the algorithms don't tell us is possible. So that your Lanny is entirely different from someone in Germany's Lanny is absolutely right and good. And it might possibly even be an emancipatory thing for us all in the way that we're supposed to read in very culturally specific ways. Like, the irony of Lanny is that it's the most English book of all time in some ways. And also, I hope not at all. I hope it translates. You know, it's a series of two-dimensional templates slid on for the reader's engagement. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I wonder about Lanny in the ways he's not captured by language. If his sense of wonder and playfulness and the way he roams the town unsupervised, the way he has an uncanny ability to navigate a garden maze without hesitation, if this is somehow related to the parts of him that that escape description, that sort of escape words.
I want the whiff of miracle on him,
yeah.
I think, slightly.
No, he
like,
does
I,
have it.
I want that. And before this was a poem I wrote 10 years ago about Pete and Lanny, way before that I used to write nonsense verse. And the reason I wrote nonsense verse because it satisfied me in a way that actual poetry didn't. And it's one of the reasons I've got more and more into that kind of poetry where language collapses and isn't apparently conventional realist language or description or lyric. And one of these was, you know, it ended up being in my first book a bit, but like, rinted flack is snutch cock ran to black done Lanny glass dorgin smooth flat back. And I wanted it to be more like, you know, almost like the Jabberwocky.
Yeah.
That these kind of spell-like incantatory things, which would be the oral tradition so that you tell that round a fireplace, a bit like Ridley Walker, and no one knows what you're saying effectively, but that you know that there is power in those, you know that there is power around the word Lanny. You know, and actually from the Haida tradition and stuff like that, like a lot of indigenous poetic traditions have that, where actually the narrative tools around the name aren't important, but you know that name is a receptacle of great power, and it's the reader's job to do the investment, not the author's at all. He's just a vessel.
With Lanny sort of escaping description, and Mad Pete and sort of working beyond language too as a visual artist. The other sort of primary person that escapes being reduced by language is non-human. It's the shape-shifting, hard-to-pin-down dead Papa Toothwort that you mentioned earlier. So I was hoping you could conjure him for us and Dead Papa Toothwort's unusual relationship to language himself.
He's a kind of mythic voyeur who's lived underneath or next to or in this place for as long as it's been a place. He is the place. He's the sort of spirit of the place. And he feasts when he's awake, because sometimes he sleeps, on the voices of the place, and he listens. He's like a kind of pervert for language, really, and he's not interested in good or bad language. None of the hierarchical considerations that we have in the world are relevant to him. He just likes to listen to human beings, and he's particularly into us now, because obviously we've been never talked as much as we do. Like, we're always talking to each other, and we're sending text messages, and we're chatting, and we're on the phones a lot. So as someone that loves language in all its forms, he's just gorging on this place. He's like a sommelier, do you know what I mean? Like, he loves cussing, and he loves banter and gossip and jokes, and he sort of delights on the hypocrisy of the place. So he's like, he scrolls through the village like it's all the soap operas, you know, late at night when you just want to watch TV, and you're kind of feasting on the crapness of it, really. And he's in that, that's how he relates to human beings, and yet there is this thing that he's got this special taste for, he's fallen in love with, which is Lanny.
There's also another thing that you've described Dead Papa Toothwort as. So on the one hand, as you described, he feeds off of language, but on the other hand, much like the crow in Grief Is a Thing with Feathers, you've described him as a linguistic disruptor, someone that gives you the opportunity to break the conventions or conventional syntax that might not otherwise get employed in a book. But I also kind of wondered if that linguistic disruptor, both The Crow and Dead Papa Toothwort, is also sort of a disruptor of business as usual in a bigger way, like the violation of conventions and of maybe tired routines of people in an unthinking way sort of sleepwalking through their existence.
Or even better, tired sentences. You know, tired syntax. Let's disrupt and energize that, definitely. There is more of that in The Crow linguistically, I think, because he's actually a poet's worst nightmare, best nightmare. So he's actually bringing with him, you know, Beckett and Joyce and you know, Cummings and all that stuff, because he's on the attack, and his medicine box is full of language. Dead Papa Toothwort would be the same, but more with narrative, with history. So he brings to the present, he collapses the past into the present. And I want that because I want the wisdom of the trickster, I suppose, but also the kind of anti-canonical energy of the historical trickster. Like, he's anarchic about the self-importance of the present. So he would be like, you know, your microwave dinner is, you know, he would link the microwave dinner circa 2017 to, you know, the Anglo-Saxon gruel of 670, or, you know, the flirting on WhatsApp of 2018 with the sexual abuses of a Roman soldier in 40 AD, and that's just his. And, you know, that to me, like, just wakes the whole thing up. And it's also a joy to write, and I hope it's kind of pleasurable to read, and it's funny, because I'm kind of poking fun at the kind of patriarchal instinct to tell history as a story, you know. So he's taking the piss out of England's sense of itself as an island story with a beginning, a middle, and end, and great moments. He's like, the great moments mean nothing to him, and in fact the only really significant moments for him would be environmental ones, because he is green. He's like he's the verdant spirit of the place, so he notices pollution, and he would be noticing the coming up, apocalypse. But he wouldn't notice, you know, Brexit,
right?
Which is kind of that's why this book has, I hope, a kind of cathartic possibility for contemporary British readers, because like, we always, you know, Dead Papa Toothwort, like, if brought in a kind of therapeutic fashion, would be like, you've always been run by a small elite. They've always been in it for themselves. Poor people have always been fucked over by rich people. And people have generally, the exception to the rule has been good forestry and good husbandry of the land, taking care of the land with sustainability in mind, thinking of the children. That selflessness has been the exception to the rule. Generally, people have taken and taken and taken. Mm. And I don't need to, like, you're nodding because you've read the book and it's in there, right? But I don't need to say that anywhere in the book. That's his philosophy, and he comes armed with it. And he's a creature of our time. He's not a bushy green tendrilled, you know, spirit of the land nymph. He's made of, it says on the first page, he's made of old condoms and broken bits of fiberglass and junk and gasoline and bits of broken Victorian medicine bottles. So I hope I state my point relatively clearly on page one. You know, we've poisoned this place for good.
Yeah. Well, other than Lanny, Mad Pete, and Dead Papa Toothwort, everyone else seems to be carrying around an unexamined darkness, sort of a existential anxiety that is shaping their lives, whose cause I don't think anyone is able to grasp themselves. So Lanny's parents have moved to the countryside for tranquility, but there's a sense of menace under the surface. Lanny's dad is all consumed by his job in the city. Lanny's mom is writing hyper-violent crime thrillers. The dad is paranoid someone is looking into the house. The mom is receiving prank phone calls that unnerve her. And even the local creatures are seen as inconveniences to dispose of rather than something to learn from. So I was hoping maybe you'd read two short sections that evoke the inner lives of Lanny's parents.
Lanny's dad. I wake up fists clenched and buzzing, certain as someone downstairs, someone in the house. I used to get this a lot, but I'm more accustomed to the sound of the village now. I know a hedgehog making his way along the planted borders. I know the postman's early footsteps on the gravel. I know the alien hum of Mrs. Larton's late night tumble drying. This isn't that. This is a human body moving. There is someone in my house. I don't wake her. I get the cricket bat from the wardrobe and the little bones in my feet crack as I tiptoe out of the bedroom. My pulse is loud in my ears as I creep across the landing and pause, listening at the top of the stairs. Nothing but my thump, thump, thump. Gingerly down the stairs, nothing. The words in my brain from the script of terrified male homeowner. Come on then, you fucking fuck. And a bladder squirm because I have no actual defensive power. I am not brave. I do not fight. I have never fought. I work in asset management and only fight in subtle ways on Microsoft Outlook. I'm terrified. There's nobody in the kitchen, but it shits me up being in there, imagining someone looking in, loads of them, lines and lines of men with Hessian faces, with razor wire and acid, farmers by day, killers by night, invisible just beyond the window pane, watching one of their number stalk me through this house. Jesus, it scares and humiliates me. So I start to swagger a bit, performing the just looking in case I'm being watched. How daft to be worried about what people think, even as I genuinely think there's an intruder in my home. Nobody in the hallway. Nobody in the lounge, no axe between my shoulder blades, no shotgun pointed to the back of my head, just the dark corners of my house in front of me, just the interior designed by my stylish wife, my own reflection, and I fling open the understairs cupboard, and I feel a proper chest pain, an angina spasm of dread, and then there's a tight squawk from upstairs. Robert! I run up three steps at a time, imagining with absolute conviction and clarity that there is a big man in a dark cloak in my bedroom, and he has a knife against my wife's throat, and I stride in, bat raised, and she's sitting up in bed. I heard something. Me too, I can't find anything. My ballsy woman, she looks terrified. She whispers, in here. There's someone in here. There's something in the room. I run over, bat in hand, and I jump in bed beside her, suddenly childlike and not brave at all. I think of newspapers printing photos of our bloodstained walls. My heart is whomping in my chest. Is he in the wardrobe? Is he made of the sheets? Is he in the ceiling? Is he in my wife's skin? Is she hiding him? Can I kill a person? Will it hurt? Will he torture us? I'm frightened. I'm frightened. There's a rustle and a movement right here under us. With us. There's a man under our bed. In the bedroom. We're going to be killed in our beds. She is gripping my hand as hard as she gripped it when our son came ripping his way into the world. I need to do this. Maybe it's a lost cat or a frightened refugee or a dying fox or a robed poltergeist. I need to do this quickly and surprise myself with bravery. So without too much pause, curiously calmed by the recognition that she needs me, that I'm caring for her, I swing out of bed. And I roll and land on the floor with a thump and raise my arm, ready to swipe the bat hard across the carpet, ready to smash my bat again and again into the face of a man. Under the bed, eyes wide open, possibly asleep, possibly awake, is Lanny. Lying stiff and long like a rolled-up rug with his arms by his side under our bed, gazing beyond me. Our child. No expression whatsoever on his face.
I hope you're going to do your audiobook.
Ah, someone already did it.
They did it?
Yeah, they used actors, yeah.
Could we hear Lanny's mom on page 98, too?
Lanny's mom. I can't sleep. Robert's breathing sounds like a small door catching the carpet as it opens. Click, scuff, somebody enter. Click, scuff somebody leave. I usually sleep well. The village is tight and muggy tonight. When I was very unwell, when Lanny was a baby in London, I read all sorts of things designed to scare young mums about cot death and crushing, choking and allergies, flat skulls and bent backs, damaged eyes and bad milk. And one night, I woke up and Lanny wasn't breathing, and I accepted it. I accepted it easily. It was the middle of the night and I was thirsty and I'd forgotten my lines and the duvet was boiling. I'd been dreaming about that film where the man in the barn pretends to be Jesus. The streetlights were toxic yellow through the curtains and the baby had died. I lay very still. I didn't touch him. I didn't scream. I didn't move or wonder where Robert was or panic or cry. I just lay still and I could think clearly. It's over now. And you can have yourself back, I thought to myself. This tragedy will be the story of your whole life, but it's your life, and you can sleep forever and ever if needs be. You've won sleep and lost fear. No more baby. I remember that night, and I strangely cherish it.
We've been listening to Max Porter read from his latest book, Lanny.
Weird that you'd ask me to read those bits, because I was going to read those bits at the bookstore tonight.
Oh, you really were?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still grieving right now that you're not doing the audiobook. I really am.
Well, the difficult thing about it, the audiobook is really good. They've done a good job. There's different actors. Pete's great. Robert's great. They're all brilliant. Jolie's particularly good, actually. But in an audiobook, if you can't hear everything, or there's overlap or something, then people send it back. They complain that it's faulty. Yeah. So the village voice, which should be overlapping, overheard, just mumbled, it should be like this, right? Glenda and I were drawing our support for the bell rope. Whenever agricultural consulting, but in with Oscar, you should come along before the bypass. You could watch the fogs. You know, just like people's lives. You know?
Yeah.
But because it's so accurate, it's like, Bunning with Oscar, you should come along before the bypass. And you're like, oh, that's a bit clear.
Yeah,
that doesn't sound overheard. That sounds performed.
Well, for people who haven't seen the book yet, these sections when Dead Papa Toothwarter is peering in and listening to language, a lot of the language is literally undulating and overlaid on top of each other.
It's dancing over the margins, so it doesn't look like text. It doesn't look like literature. It attempts to look like sound.
Well, the reason why I wanted you to read both of those pieces, the sort of darkness inside of Lanny's parents, is because it feels like, on the one hand, Lanny's also sort of criticizing a tabloid sort of fetishization of missing child cases. Because at one point, when people can't find Lanny, everyone sort of starts to assume the worst of the people they know. So they assume, oh, these benign art lessons with Mad Pete, maybe Mad Pete had this perverse other life that's going on.
Yeah.
And then people all of a sudden are criticizing Lanny's parents for allowing him to roam around the town unsupervised. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, they're terrible parents. And I was thinking about that in relationship to the way childhood has changed over the last half century, largely based on irrational fears around child abduction, when the number of child abductions, at least in the United States, hasn't actually gone up over that time, but our entire way of raising children has changed based on this fear. And there's this essay, I don't know if you're familiar with it, by Michael Chabon that he wrote maybe 10 years ago, where he wrote an essay about what he called the wilderness of childhood. And in it, he argues that the reasons there are maps in adventure stories and fantasy stories is not to provide the opportunity for people to armchair travel, but rather because of a certain type of childhood that they've already had.
Mm.
And this is what he says. We have this idea of armchair traveling, of the reader who seeks in the pages of a ripping yarn or a memoir of polar exploration the kind of heroism and danger in unknown, half-legendary lands that he or she could never hope to find in life. This is a mistaken notion, in my view. People read stories of adventure and write them because they have themselves been adventurers. Childhood is, or has been, or ought to be, the great original adventure, a tale of privation, courage, constant vigilance, danger, and sometimes calamity. For the most part, the young adventurer sets forth equipped only with the fragmentary map, marked Here There Be Tigers and Mean Kid with Air Rifle that he or she has been able to construct out of a patchwork of personal misfortune, bedtime reading, and the accumulated local lore of the neighborhood children. And then later in the same essay, he says this: "The thing that strikes me now when I think about the wilderness of childhood is the incredible degree of freedom my parents gave me to adventure there. A very grave, very significant shift in our idea of childhood has occurred since then. The wilderness of childhood is gone. The days of adventure are past. The land ruled by children, to which a kid might exile himself for at least some portion of every day from the neighboring kingdom of adulthood, has in large part been taken over, co-opted, colonized, and finally absorbed by the neighbors." This is sort of my long way of bringing us back to Lanny and the decision that you do of portraying Lanny in the now-gone wilderness of childhood. At least in my mind, it feels like he's wandering in a childhood that also that is as a wilderness has also been destroyed.
Well, that's beautiful. I love that shape on thing. I mean, that's it. I wonder if forced to put a date on it, whether you put a date on it. I mean, is it kind of, because I had it. So maybe is it the 90s? What? I don't know.
I don't know either.
I mean, I don't. When I first wrote Lanny, we had this thing going on in the UK called Operation Yew Tree, which was the gradual exposing of men in the light entertainment industry as having been sexual abusers, predatory sexual abusers. It's a bit like Me Too. Like, there was barely anyone that wasn't screwing around either with kids or with interns or with, you know, or with assistants or whatever. You know, like, men are assholes was the kind of, like, finding, as is the case. But it meant that there was a complete and sudden evaporation of trust. So you can't leave anyone with anyone anymore, and you can't even go to the park anymore, and you can't, certainly as a man, a single man, you can't go and sit in the park because you might be looking at kids or whatever it is, you know, this. And this was engineered and accelerated and controlled, puppeteered by the tabloid newspapers to sell papers. So it was always completely irrational and took on the tones of a hunt. So, you know, we had like paedophile hunters, as I'm sure you've had here, and all this kind of stuff. So, it, you know, militaristic overtones and all that, the kind of Cub Scout stuff. So the same kind of language you actually see now with the Brexiteers, like reclaiming England, or with the kind of eco-fascist movement. Like, it all takes the language of like adventure. It's co-opted the language of adventure in a really regretful way, as we see from Michael Chabon's thing. With Lanny, like, there's a sense that what the finding of the thing afterwards, because obviously some people assume that it's dodgy, some people already thought it was dodgy, some people have their worst suspicions confirmed, other people discover within themselves what you might even call a kind of social hunch or whatever, and they have that then confirmed or denied. And most people only, I don't want this to be a moralistic book, but most people discover that actually you shouldn't listen to anyone else. You should develop your own opinions about things, you know, based on what it's actually like. So, like, how dangerous is it to put a kid out into the world? Like, what are the actual risks? If you're analytical about it, they might slip and bang their head in the river. It's a bit like terrorism. What, you know, like the chances of being blown up by a fundamentalist Islamist terrorist is something like less than the chance of choking on, like, a raspberry flavored lollipop, right? We can be that specific about the unlikelihood of that happening, and look at the multi-billion-dollar industry to scare us about Islamic terrorism. And it's the same with children in the wild. The other thing in the UK specifically, there isn't much wild left. It's a very, very small place, and so actually the wild is now owned and chopped, and so this goes hand in hand with like a need for us all to like linguistically interrogate the very idea of outside anyway. It's the same as we're going to interrogate the idea of home, as Ursula K. Guin suggests. So, yeah, I love that shape on piece. That seems about right to me. And I suppose that's how this began as a sort of heartbreak song, was, are we going to be able to have this kind of friendship anymore.
Between Mad Pete, the older artist, and Lanny, for one instance.
But even, you know, like, even like the heteronormative environment is disappointing, isn't it? Like, early responses, because, like, does Jolie fancy Pete? Like, is there sexual tension between Jolie? And I'm like, well, yes, in as much as there's sexual tension between you and me sitting here now. Like, the binaries are so flat and counterproductive, aren't they? And so oppressive. Like, any way of describing things with an either or a yes or no is terribly... is persecution of the possibility, the emotional possibilities of life on this planet. So all I want is that, as I said earlier, like that ambivalence to thrive in this relationship. They don't know. You know, and Lanny intuits and guesses that Pete's a homosexual, but that's not a discovery that needs a great deal of fanfare attached to it. He's curious about it, you know.
Well, if we were to take this idea of wilderness of childhood to the questions of wilderness and wildness in the book, because this is a big open question for me of how we can reorient storytelling so that our stories can help enact what we need to do as a species at large. Because I feel like poetry has done this for a long time, and science fiction has also, but just in stories that aren't science fictional or not poems. Stephen Sparks, who you just met, the owner of Point Reyes Books, after reading Lanny, he tweeted something that echoes my feelings. He said, "I've grown weary of literature that limits itself to exclusively human concerns. We need more work by writers with imaginations capacious enough to see past the false distinction between human and other than human." And one way that Lanny is described in the book is as a child of the old times. Mm-hmm. And you've said in one interview that Lanny is classically druidical in his thinking.
Yeah.
That he could be said to exemplify an accomplished post-industrial Celtic metaphysic. And particularly for Americans, we probably don't entirely understand what you mean by that. So I was curious what it means to be classically druidical or to embody a Celtic metaphysic in your mind for Lanny.
It would mean that, you know, he wears a big robe, he carries a stick, it's a big white beard.
I hope so.
He listens to Pentangle. No, it would mean like he only smokes the finest weed, you know. What I mean by that, and actually this is thinking that is ongoing with Lanny as a kind of root rather than a leaf. And I was talking to Stephen about this last night. Like, the basic animist proposition from which Druids would borrow from these days is a contemporary system of thought, so slightly separate from the Celtic metaphysic, is that there are many, many beings alive on this planet, only some of which are human, and that the undoing of the idea of Homo sapiens superiority is the only means to sustainability to surviving on this planet, and that we therefore have to actively. Rewilding is not quite the right word, but we actually have to actively undo some of the kind of ills of industrialized life and so on and so forth. But Lanny with the Celtic metaphysic, that would just mean circular thinking, understanding that life and death are linked, seasonal thinking, like that's the basic thing. Like Druids were... In the same, I ought to think more about Lanny as a Druid. Actually, Druids weren't. There's no text. There's no Bible. There's no authority. The Druid is simply the person who, on behalf of the rest of the community, learns as much as he or she possibly can about everything. Mm. So they become medicine man and judge and lawyer, but never for personal gain. There's not the Druid isn't superior to the community. The Druid is just vital to the community, like a living thing. And there is no more. Like there's the elders of the forest, there's particular trees, but basically the oak, the tree, and the oak in particular, is the ultimate symbol of growth because of the ways in which it can be collaborated with to help human life sustain itself, but also unless it's well cared for, unless you have good forestry or coppicing, or I mean, I talk about this in my first book, then you only use and you don't regrow. So the Celtic metaphysic will basically be, in Lanny's sense, will be a sense of the indebtedness. Depth of gratitude, really, and understanding of the obligation of human partners in furthering both life cycle, you know, both life forms, all life forms, but also an attentiveness being in tune with the natural world rather than the consumer world or the chemical world or the, you know, whatever else it is. So that would be how it is mainly.
You probably already answered my next question, which was, tell us about why you opened the book with a poem about a tree by Lynette Roberts. And,
I love that poem.
Maybe you could just read it for us. And
yeah.
Then
I'm about to have this poem tattooed on my arm, actually.
Are you serious?
Just the first line, yeah, because I realized that the first line of this poem encompasses my entire philosophy.
Oh, wow.
And contains two of my favorite words.
I'm glad you're going
to
read it then.
And I had this poem read at my wedding, so it speaks to me of my wife as well. And also my children and I have a good relationship with this poem. And it's Welsh. And it's gorgeous, right? What a poem. Peace, my stranger is a tree. Growing naturally through all its discomforts, trials, and emergencies of growth. It is green and resolved. It breathes with anguish, yet it releases peace, peace of mind, growth, movement. It walks this greening sweetness throughout all the earth, where sky and sun tender its habits as I would yours. Such a nice poem. That's by Lynette Roberts. It's called Green Madrigal. She was an interesting person, actually. She was kind of in a group of people around Dylan Thomas and was, you know, was sort of ignored, but also was really at that time building these incredible social documentary accounts of local dialects and stuff like that, and local industry, you know, like what people actually did with their hands, you know, dyeing industries basically. So she had a kind of archaeological, she's actually quite a tooth-warty person. Yeah, peace, my stranger is a tree. I love the oceans, but I love Ocean Vuong very much as a person and a writer. And I love that his blurb picked up on this question of otherness, which is not something that English readers have particularly picked up on because they're so fixated with the Englishness of the book and whether it's a Brexit novel and stuff like that. But actually, if you strip all that out and watch it as if it were a stage play, and these are two-dimensional figures being slid on, why are they being slid on? To challenge the immediacy of our hostility to others.
Yeah.
Always, you know? And the other within ourselves, or within our own family, even, or, you know, the other might even be a thought. Doesn't need to be a person coming into a community.
Well, when you were describing an anthology of landscape poetry called The Ground Aslant, you say that your discovery of radical eco-poetry has changed your idea of what language means in the Anthropocene. But you also go on to say that you feel that the poem and the tree are linked, that the poem and the tree are siblings, and that you seek work that examines this. And I imagine this poem by Lynette Roberts is one of those examples. But tell us more about the poem and the tree.
Well, I find the tree a relatively useful shadow structure for all life. I think about the tree when I think about my own longevity or lack of as a person, you know, as a living thing. I think about it when I think of marriage. I think about it for friendship. I think about it for literature and the production of literature and the culture industry. I think about it with art. There is no better working model of the ways in which ideas are transmuted, the way in which some things become, host attacking, would you call them, aggressive things latch onto living things and soak energy. Like, there, to me, you can use a tree as has evidently been the case throughout the history of science. People have used trees to carry information, to best display information.
Yeah. Well, it was a pleasure having you on the show today.
Thanks so much. It's been great.
We're talking today to Max Porter about his latest book from Grey Wolf Press, Lanny. You've been listening to Between the Covers.
Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 29 de julio del 2021. La variante Delta, altamente contagiosa, está provocando un aumento de casos en todo el mundo, desde los Juegos Olímpicos de Tokio hasta Rusia, Indonesia y los Estados Unidos. La Organización Mundial del Comercio no ha vuelto a ponerse de acuerdo sobre una propuesta para renunciar temporalmente a los derechos de propiedad intelectual de las vacunas contra el coronavirus. Los oponentes claves a la propuesta incluyen a la Unión Europea, Japón y Corea del Sur.